Now let's turn to the classical theory of capitalism's future, the history of capitalism's future. That's the way I like to think of what historical materialism is all about. It's a theory of the history of the future, not the history of the past. The grand effort of historical materialism to create a history of the past, that is, of how we got to the present, was strictly, I think, in aid of a theory of the history of the future. That was its theoretical function. And that's why I argue that even if it's not all that satisfactory, if the particular construction by how we got from ancient primordial human communities to contemporary capitalism, even if that part of historical materialism has just too many weaknesses to be seen as a satisfactory theoretical structure, that doesn't in and of itself indict the theory of the history of capitalism's future. Because the history of capitalism's future really has its own autonomous arguments about the mechanisms in capitalism, its laws of motion, and the conditions under which capitalism could be transcended. So what I'd like to do then is the following. Some of this will repeat things we have touched on at various times. We talked a little bit about this earlier in the semester. But I'm going to once again go over the structure of the traditional Marxist theory, its overall architecture. I'm going to break that architecture down into five central theses and explain what they mean. So that's just kind of explicating the argument. And then I'll discuss the inadequacies, where that classical theory really isn't satisfactory. And then ask, where does that leave us? The final punchline, in a sense, is something that is announced in the title of the course. I think we need to move from historical materialism to sociological materialism, basically class analysis. That there's good grounds for the critique of capitalism and understanding how its contradictions open up certain possibilities and create certain dilemmas, and that these possibilities and dilemmas are rooted in the character of its class relations, and that's the kind of core of a sociological Marxist approach to the problem of capitalism. But that it's more accurate to see it as a structural theory of the dynamics of a particular set of institutions than a theory of history itself. And it, in the end, doesn't really give us anything but the shadows of a theory of the history of capitalism's future, because it doesn't really give us a capacity to predict a trajectory, just to diagnose the dilemmas along the trajectory that actually occurs, but not to predict it. And so, I mean, we can call it a theory of the history of capitalism's future if you like, but I think it's better to think of it as sociological Marxism. That's the punchline of this. Okay, the overall structure. That's reflected in this picture, which I think defines the basic contours of how the theory of capitalism's future is built. There's an account of the nature of capitalism as an economic structure and its internal contradictions, and how those internal contradictions change over time by virtue of the fundamental properties of capitalism. So the term that's often used is that there are laws of motion of capitalism. That's a way of talking about the causal structures in capitalism that push it forward, change it in a systematic, non-haphazard way. So we can say something about the developmental trajectory of capitalism. And the particular something that Marxists talk about are how that developmental trajectory is fraught with a set of contradictions. That generates two causal streams. And it's the coincidence of these two causal streams set in motion by the same basic structure that provides the theory of the history of capitalism's future. One causal stream works through the falling rate of profit to produce the long-term non-sustainability of capitalism. That's the top of this picture. And the second causal stream works through the growth of the working class to the emergence of collective actors capable of challenging capitalism. And that's where the real elegance of this theory comes from. It's simultaneously a theory of the evolution, the contradictory evolution of the structure of capitalism and of the production of collective agents within that structure capable of challenging it. You know, so if you want a theory, as it were, that would enable you to predict something about the future of capitalism, that would be relevant to an emancipatory project, that's exactly the kind of theory you'd want. Tells you that in the future, the system is going to be more fragile, more vulnerable, not more robust. This is a system that doesn't tend to accumulate stability, which continually reinforce and strengthen it over time. No, it's a system, by virtue of its structural logic, tendentially produces its own weakness over time. But that by itself would not yet be enough to predict an outcome, since the outcomes depend upon human action and agency, and particularly collective capacity. And the theory also then predicts the growth of a collective actor capable of challenging that structure. Let's break this down. Let's look at each of the theses which constitute this collective structure of argument. First, and these are labels that I've given to, you know, this. You should, by the way, these are five theses. This is my way of breaking down, parsing the overall theory and my labels for them. This isn't part of the kind of standard expositional strategy, although I don't think there's anything inconsistent with what I have to say in the usual way of talking about it. So first, the long-term non-sustainability of capitalism thesis. And this states that in the long run, capitalism is an unsustainable economic system. Its internal dynamics systematically undermine the conditions of its own reproducibility, thus making capitalism more and more fragile over time and eventually unsustainable. This thesis does not imply that the only conditions under which capitalism can be overthrown is if it completely disintegrates and collapses on its own. So this isn't, sometimes people interpret this claim about capitalism and its tendency to destroy its own conditions of existence. Sometimes people interpret this as meaning that there's no point in struggling against capitalism because eventually it's going to destroy itself. That's not the implication of this. The implication is that it becomes easier and easier to destroy it. But there's absolutely no reason for the collective agents who have an interest in destroying it to wait until the point where it collapses completely. Yeah?
The first interpretation of this, I always thought it was the way it was interpreted in the past, this claim that capitalism would, collapse.
Yes, so the prediction is that it would eventually collapse, but the implication of that claim is not that we wait until that point to challenge it.
Yeah.
Right, so you challenge it, and because it's destroyable before the point at which it would inevitably collapse. It's not that it remains intact, you know, for so many decades and then suddenly collapses. No, it becomes weaker and weaker, and at some point it's weak enough to destroy, and that's earlier than it would just collapse on its own. And so this is not a call for inaction. It's just a promise that you will eventually succeed. That's the key feature of this part of the thesis. If it's true that eventually capitalism becomes unsustainable, and as it becomes closer to the point of unsustainability, it becomes weaker. If that's true, that's a declaration to people who oppose capitalism, get your act together so that you'll be in a position to challenge it effectively as soon as possible. You don't have to wait till the collapse. It's a promise of success in the long term. And that's an enormously powerful idea. That's really an important idea. It's not just saying you're on the side of history because you're on the side of the angels, you know, because you're moral in a world of evil. No, it's you're on the side of history because history is doing part of the work of making success possible. History meaning all the structural dynamics that are occurring in your context. This prediction is based on four empirical observations that Marx made in the 19th century, combined with a theoretical argument about the mechanisms which generate these trends. So this prediction really, I think, exactly has the character, kind of from a methodological point of view, of predictions about climate change. That is, how do theorists of climate change work? They create a set of empirical observations of what's happened over the last century on a whole variety of indicators. They observe these trends. They then propose a set of underlying mechanisms which explain these trends. They create a set of formulas such that with those mechanisms and those formulas, they can show how those trends get generated. And from that, they predict the future. That is, they extend the trends beyond the present and say if these trends were to continue, if the empirical trends continue, then our model tells you what's going to happen. Right? So that's what a simulation model does. Marx is basically doing a simulation exercise in his discussion of the history of the future of capitalism. So what are the empirical trends? Okay, here's four trends, which I think are pretty accurate. These are empirical trends. These are things you can observe in the 19th century when Marx is writing. So you're sitting at your desk in the British Museum, in the library, you know, that famous reading room. You're being paid by Engels. He's supplying you with the necessary means to be able to devote your time to your research and study. You have this great fellowship. And you study the history and you've got these four trends. Trend number one, in the course of capitalist development, the level of productivity increases enormously, particularly because of the productivity gains from increasing capital intensity of production. You look at what's happened in the course of the 19th century, by the time you're sitting down in the 1860s, and you observe, yes, there's this trend of incessantly increasing productivity. And this productivity is coming to a significant extent because of increasing capital intensity. More and more capital is being deployed per worker and producing this enormous increase in productivity. That's your first trend. Second trend, capitalism expands relentlessly in a double sense. More and more domains of production are commodified and organized by capitalist firms, and capitalist markets extend to ever wider reaches of the world. A deepening of capitalism and a globalization of capitalism. Things that were previously produced in the home are now produced in factories. Take clothing as an example. In 1700, most people wore clothing which they themselves or their families or their networks made. They did not go to a shop to buy their clothing. By the end of the 19th century, most people bought their clothing in stores. That's a commodification of clothing. I don't know, the commodification of textiles, that is the cloth from which you make clothing, occurred earlier than the commodification of clothing. That is, it was an earlier point in which you would go and buy the cloth and then make the clothing than when you would go and actually buy the clothing. But you can see these things are moving in a pretty linear way. Food is, of course, the most dramatic example. There was a time in which nearly everybody ate food which they grew themselves. They didn't go to a market for them. By the end of the 19th century, the vast majority of people in the industrialized world bought their food in stores. That's the deepening of capitalism, commodification. It's a good trend, we see it. And globalization. The markets are extending to places where markets didn't exist before. Marx actually is probably, I mean, he's often thought of as the first, he may not be literally the first theorist of globalization, but he certainly was the first person whose writing put that at the one of the centerpieces of his arguments, that capitalism would spread and dominate the entire globe. Third trend. Capitalist development tends to increase the concentration and centralization of capital. Over time, capitalist firms become larger and larger, and the percentage of the production in the market controlled by these large firms increases. They become bigger. That's the concentration of capital. They become centralized. The percentage of the production in the market controlled by large firms is the centralization, and the size of the firms is the concentration. Centralization refers to the domination of the market. You could have firms getting bigger without the percentage of the firms of the market controlled by the largest firms increasing. You could just, because the market could be expanding more rapidly than the size of firms were increasing. So the size of firms is increasing to the point that they're dominating the market. They're not just getting bigger. This means that not only does the world become ever more organized through capitalist markets, those markets become ever more dominated by giant firms. That was a trend he saw in the 19th century. Pretty powerful trend, and with some nuances and special asterisks to explain exactly what you mean by the concentration of capital, that's a trend which continues into the 20th century and beyond. Finally, the economic crises that periodically disrupt capitalist markets and production tend to become more serious and prolonged as capitalism develops. The economic crises at the end of the 19th century are more severe than at the beginning of the 19th century. And the economic crises that we've seen in the 20th century, at least some of them, are more severe than the ones we saw in the 19th century. Those are four observable trends. And then what Marx basically said is, okay, we've got these trends. What laws of motion would explain the trends? So you can't simply re-describe the trends as laws of motion. No, you have to have a mechanism. You need some underlying causal process which is generative of these trends. And that's essentially what his arguments in Capital are about. That's what he's trying to decode, is the underlying mechanisms which generate the trends. The pivot of the theory is the particular trends that render the system more fragile, right? So it's not just, his theory does a lot to explain why capitalism spreads, why markets dominate production, why commodification deepens. And I think that part of his theory remains pretty much intact. It's capitalist competition and the imperatives of accumulation that drive that expansionary character of capitalist development. Rather than capitalism just being content to remain within some particular place at some particular scale, no, there are internal dynamics which lead it to spread and so on. So, and that also helps to explain this relentless increase in productivity and the concentration and centralization of capital. The part of the argument that becomes the most pivotal to the theory of capitalism's futures, however, is the fourth trend, the trend about economic crisis. Because that's the bit that helps to anchor the argument about the system becoming more fragile over time. The pivot of this theory is what's called the law of the falling tendency of the rate of profit, which I've mentioned a couple of times in the course. Underlying this law, there are really two components. There are two aspects of the theory which have different mechanisms. Not one. There's a cluster of of distinct mechanisms involved. First, there's a theory of the periodic rises and falls in the rate of profit, which generate what we now call business cycles. So Marx had a theory that's the basic elements of which are present in Keynes as well, and in subsequent crisis theories. He has a basic theory of cyclical crisis, periodic crises. There are many factors which contribute to cyclical crises, but mostly they're can be subsumed under another classical Marxian slogan, the anarchy of the market. The uncoordinated character of market interactions, which includes, for example, the tendency of capitalist firms to produce more than the market can absorb. That's called overproduction. Or the tendency of capitalists to push the wages of their workers down in order to reduce costs, thus depressing the demand in the market. That's called underconsumption. Underconsumption and overproduction occur as tendencies because of the strategies of capitalists, and they generate crises, and in the crises, production is destroyed. The capitalist firms go bankrupt, so the overproduction part gets solved. When the overproduction part gets solved just because of bankruptcies and the dissolution of firms, then the remaining firms are able to sell their products. As labor markets tighten, wages begin to rise, and so on. There's this cyclical movement, but that cyclical movement is just a sine wave. There's no particular tendency for it to become worse or better over time. These are the processes related to economic crisis mechanisms that Keynes talks about. You know, I mean, there's a lot more to Keynes than just this, but I think it's at the heart of the same intuitions. That gives you cycles. But cycles aren't enough. Marx's theory of crisis is not just a theory of cycles. That doesn't give you increasing fragility of the system. You need something that would explain why the amplitudes of those crises will get worse over time, and why the recovery, the resilience of the system, its absorption capacity in the face of those crises declines over time. And this is where the theory of the falling rate of profit becomes critical. Marx lays out a causal process through which the rate of profit gradually declines in capitalist economies across business cycles. So if you think of a business cycle as a cycle between positive and negative profits, right? So at the peak of a cycle, you're having high positive profits, and then they begin to decline, and in a depth of a crisis, you're losing money, so you have negative profits, and then conditions restore and you go back up. The falling rate of profit thesis is that the peaks get lower over time. It's more that the peaks get lower than that the troughs get deeper. There's a tendency to think that the theory is symmetrical around that the troughs get deeper. That's not actually necessarily the case, although there are some reasons why you might think as the peaks get lower, that in and of itself will mean the troughs will get deeper when a crisis occurs. But that's not the key. The key part of the argument is that the peaks get lower. And if the peaks get lower, then the average declines over time. What's the mechanism? Well, the key idea here is that the aggregate profits in a capitalist economy depend upon the production of an economic surplus. The key idea is an interpretation of profits as the monetized value of the surplus produced. That is, producing more than is required simply to reproduce the inputs used up in production, both the capital inputs and the labor inputs. So the key point is that the monetary value of the surplus is what we call profits. The rate of profit, then, is the ratio between the value of the surplus product and the value of all the inputs that are used up in production. That is, you have the value of all the inputs that are used in production, and then you have something produced that's more than that, call it surplus. And the rate of profit is the ratio of the value of that surplus to the value of everything underneath. The key problem then is, what do we mean by the value of the surplus? And that's where the labor theory of value fits in the argument. The argument then is that the value of all products is determined by the amount of labor time embodied in their production. That's the labor theory of the value of the surplus and the value of the denominator, the value of the costs of production. And since it's only labor that's generating this value, it's a labor theory of value, if capital intensity goes up so that the labor contribution to the total value of the total product goes down, then what you're going to have is the denominator expanding more rapidly than the numerator, because the capital component of the denominator is replacing the labor component of the denominator. It's essentially an argument about what happens as capital intensity goes up to the capacity of the system to produce surplus value. It's not about the capacity of the system to produce a surplus product with capital intensity. I mean, you could imagine in a Marxian framework that you'd have a fully automated system of production with no labor at all, where machines produce machines and machines do the mining and the processing. Just imagine, you know, the kind of hyper-extension, scientific extension of the technologies of today, where there's no people involved at all in production. So the machines are owned privately, but there's no labor involved. You'd have a surplus product, but in the labor theory of value, that surplus product wouldn't have any value because it embodies no labor. Right? So the rate of profit would be zero. Well, there's lots of things that are problematic about that claim, but accepting it for a moment, the fundamental idea of the falling rate of profit is capital intensity has a tendency to rise in capitalism because capitalists compete with each other, and increasing capital intensity increases their ability to compete. So each individual capitalist increases their own rate of profit by more effectively competing with others. But as soon as other capitalists adopt the same capital intense technologies, their advantages in the rate of profit disappear. They're competed away. And every capitalist is left with a lower average rate of profit than they had before because capital intensity is increased, and therefore the labor content of the surplus goes down. The technical term that Marx uses to describe this capital intensity problem is the organic composition of capital. That's the technical term that's used, the organic. And for some reason, for which I have absolutely no idea, in the equations that Marx's political economists use, they call it Q. The only thing I can think of is that O would be confusing, because O could be zero or O for organic composition of capital. So they called it Q because it looks kind of like an O. I mean, I have no idea why actually Q is the symbol for. So S is for surplus, and V is for variable capital. That's the capital costs of labor. And C is constant capital. That's the cost of capital. That's all quite intuitive. But Q is the ratio of constant capital to variable capital. Well, we don't need to get into the labor theory of value here. That's Marx's only argument for why the rate of profit should have a tendency to decline over time, is that capital intensity goes up. And if profits come from exploitation, and exploitation is only of living labor, of new labor added into production, and if capital intensity goes up, then the rate of profit will go down. And you can run through the equations, and if all of those definitional claims are correct, then you'll see that the rate of profit will decline over time. The long-term decline of the aggregate rate of profit means that over time, the episodic crises that occur because of this overproduction and underconsumption tendency and some other tendencies that we could add to that, that those cyclical crises will tend to become worse because there's less room to maneuver in the system. If you have an average rate of profit of 20% and you get a crisis, well, there's a lot of play in the system. A lot of firms will remain profitable even when you have a downturn. When the rate of profit is 2% on average, if it declines to that point, then when you have disruptions of production, most firms will begin to have negative profits. And so the crisis will become more intense. Yeah?
So I'm kind of skeptical of this argument of falling rate of profit or tendency to, for the profits to fall, because it's hard to see, A, in this service economy where majority of work is being mechanized. And then there are also, like, empirically it turns out to be that there are cases of profits revived even in manufacturing, like U.S. manufacturing in the 90s, despite the
economy. Right, so we'll get to the inadequacies of each of these points. That's in Roman numeral 3. After, so my strategy here is to lay out each of the arguments and then to go back to them as to where the problematic features are. Yeah, there's lots of reasons to be skeptical about this long-term tendency of the rate of profit to fall indefinitely. There's good reason to believe that the rate of profit will be, on average, lower in mature capitalist economies than in emerging economies. There's reasons why, when you're working from a very low productivity base, for the rates of profits to be higher, and for productivity gains to be higher in those earlier stages. And that's primarily because in earlier development stages, the main source of productivity gains is the shifting of production from low productivity to higher productivity sectors. Once production is all located in the higher productivity sectors, then all productivity gains come from the internal improvements of productivity within those sectors. And that just turns out to be at a slower pace than the movement of people from low productivity to higher productivity sectors of activity. But we'll get to the criticisms in a moment. Okay. Thesis 2, the intensification of anti-capitalist struggle thesis. The dynamics of capitalist development that we've just laid out systematically tend, A, to increase the proportion of the population, the working class, whose interests are pervasively hurt by capitalism, and at the same time, B, to increase the collective capacity of the working class to challenge capitalism. The result is an intensification of class struggle directed against capitalism. So if you remember the little triplet of struggles over the game, struggles over the rules of the game, and struggles over moves of the game from that earlier lecture. What this says is that there will be an increasing collective capacity to struggle against the game itself, because you'll have a higher proportion of the population whose interests are hurt by that game, not just by the particular rules in the game, but by the game itself. And they will have increasing collective capacity to organize at that level of the system, not just at the level of the particular moves that would improve their situation or the particular rules of the game. So thesis one is a proposition about the structural tendencies of capitalist development. Thesis two is a proposition about agency. It really reflects the fact that this is a theory about the connection between structure and agency. It's not a pure structuralism. It's a theory about the connection between structure and agency. It postulates that capitalism produces a collective actor with both the interest and capacity to challenge capitalism. The first part of this claim concerns what is generally called proletarianization. That is, the formation of a working class in the course of capitalist development. And that's the increase in the proportion of the population whose interests are pervasively hurt by capitalism. Proletarianization is a double process. It actually has two components. One is the destruction of all sorts of non-capitalist kinds of livelihoods. Most notably, in Marx's time, the destruction of smallholder self-employed agricultural workers and other types of independent producers that are generally called petty bourgeoisie. So the one aspect of proletarianization is the destruction of those non-capitalist ways of acquiring your livelihood. In the second half of the 20th century, this aspect of proletarianization has centered on the entry of married women into the labor force. So there's this huge reservoir of labor not engaged in capitalist production, not selling their labor power for a wage, until the last 40 or 50 years. The massive entry of married women into the labor force represents a proletarianization process in terms of this kind of classical argument. So that's one aspect of proletarianization. The second is a process through which the autonomy and skills of workers within capitalist employment are reduced through a process of work routinization and de-skilling. Taken together, these two processes of change mean that over time, the working class increases in size and in homogeneity of working conditions. The key aspect of de-skilling is it's not so much actually the reduction of skill, even though the term de-skilling is about less rather than more. It's really about the homogenization of skill. So even if one could imagine, because literacy requirements go up over time for even manual labor, they have to be able to read instructions. And we could say that a literate worker has more skills than an illiterate worker. The key issue in the theory is homogenization, that the class becomes more homogenous with respect to its conditions of work. And the routinization and de-skilling was the classic way of talking about homogenization. But really keep in mind, the pivot of the argument is homogenization, because that's what creates the set of common and accessibly understandable interests that workers would have with respect to the nature of the game. Proletarianization by itself, however, isn't enough to generate an intensification of anti-capitalist class struggles, which is what Thesis 2 is about. Since the intensity of social conflict depends not on just on the intensity of opposing interests, but also on the capacity of people to act on those opposing interests, that is, to engage in collective actions. Grievances are never sufficient to explain conflict. That is a kind of sociology 101 point. It's not just a Marxist point, but it is fundamental to every theory of social movements these days, is that it's not enough to show how harmed people are by a particular structure to explain why they do anything about it, and particularly why they do anything about it collectively. That you're harmed by a structure probably is enough to explain some of the things you do. People have to survive, they engage in all sorts of adaptive behaviors, but it's not enough to explain why they join together collectively to do something about their conditions. That requires a theory of collective capacity, how that impede or facilitate it. This is what I refer to as the problem of class formation. I like to use the term class formation to refer not primarily to the formation of the positions themselves, but to the formation of the collective capacities of people by virtue of their positions. And here Marx has another set of very persuasive arguments built upon his view of what the empirical trends were. The class capacity of workers is also generated and enhanced by the dynamics of capitalism, by increasing the scale of production and capital intensity of production. This means that the physical concentration of workers increases, which facilitates communication and coordination needed for collective action. We discussed this somewhat in our analysis of class formation earlier. In one way, I mean, Adam Shavorsky has a nice way of putting this, that capitalism organizes workers collectively before workers organize themselves. They're organized into factories in which they are interdependent and depend upon each other. Interdependent, in the technical sense, means they also interact and communicate and are in proximity. Marx has this famous contrast between the working class and peasants, in which he basically makes the point, while they may both be equally harmed by the existing structures of domination and exploitation in different ways, the peasants are more like a sack of potatoes. You know, they're all isolated from each other. They live on their own properties. They have no natural basis for coordination, whereas workers are all brought together in a concentrated way within a factory. And this is a tendency in capitalism to bring workers together. And that is the foundation for their increasing collective capacity to struggle. They share a common fate. They see each other sharing a common fate. They interact with each other. They talk to each other. They live in the same communities. All of this homogenization plus interaction plus concentration increases their capacity for struggle. And if these trends were to continue, so if we're extrapolating from the 1860s on, then the prospects of the collective capacity of the working class increasing systematically in a way that enables a challenge to capitalism becomes plausible. Okay, thesis three, the revolutionary transformation thesis. Since capitalism becomes increasingly precarious as an economic system, that's thesis one, while the principal class arrayed against capitalism becomes increasingly large and capable, and capable of challenging capitalism, that's thesis two. Because of those two arguments, eventually the social forces opposing capitalism will be sufficiently strong and capitalism itself sufficiently weak that the institutions designed to protect capitalism will no longer be able to prevent it from being overthrown. That last clause is about superstructures. That last clause, the institutions designed to protect capitalism will no longer be able to prevent it from being overthrown. Because remember, that's the whole idea of the superstructure. The superstructure is part of the original theory of the stability of capitalism that says capitalism would be fragile even before this. It would be fragile right from the get-go unless it had specialized institutions to protect it. The state in particular, but ideology as well. Ideology to confuse people, the state to repress them, you know, to state this in an overly simple way. The way to think about the state in particular is that what the state does is raises the costs of challenge. So when we think about collective action, we ask, what are the interests of the collective actors in challenging? Aha, we observe that capitalism creates a more homogeneous class with interests opposed to capitalism. We secondarily ask, what are the conditions which facilitate their collective organization? We observe, aha, capitalism brings workers together in collectivities, which makes it easier for them to form organizations of collective action. But there's a third question. What are the costs of struggle? What are the costs of struggle? Because the costs of struggle determine whether or not, in the end, it's actually worth doing. I mean, if the costs are horrendous, they may make it impossible to engage in the struggles for those particular purposes. So there's the cost of struggle over moves of the game, the cost of struggle over rules of the game, and the cost of struggle over the game itself. The superstructures have as their big responsibility, you know, this is stating it in an overly stylized way, but a way that's relevant to the point here. They're given the responsibility of making the cost of struggling over the game itself extremely high. And they're pretty good at it. You know, you look at what happens when there's efforts at struggling over the game itself, it can be pretty drastic for the collective actors. The cost of struggling over the rules of the game are generally less. Some rules are easier to struggle over than others, and the cost of struggling over the moves of the game are even less. That's one way of thinking about why, once you get the collective capacity to struggle, why you deploy it against certain kinds of targets. And why it's another reason to think about why reformism is attractive. That's just struggling over the rules of the game. It's because the costs of those struggles are lower than the cost of struggling over the game itself, in part. But the claim in the transformation thesis is this remarkably interesting claim, I think, and one that it's not given quite as much attention as the general fragility of the system. The capitalism could become more fragile, but if the capacity of superstructures to raise the cost of struggle remained intact, in spite of the fragility of capitalism, it still might be impossible to challenge it. Right? So usually the Marxian spirit is that the system becomes fragile and therefore overthrowable. And the link then is that when the system becomes fragile in that way, the state's actual capacity to raise the costs goes down. That's captured in a slogan, which of course is a slogan, "Workers of the World Unite." You have nothing to lose but your chains and a world to win. Well, that makes it sound like the costs of getting rid of your chains isn't all that great, right? You have nothing to lose. Well, you do have things to lose, of course. Now, it could be the case that these institutions would be so robust that of the superstructure that they would just maintain an oppressive form of capitalism with low rates of profit and increasing immiseration because they remain intact. So what is the reason why you think that this superstructure itself will lose its capacity to reproduce the system? Well, there's one part of it which is relatively easy. The ideological superstructures are likely to become much more transparent and unpersuasive when capitalism enters into this period of fragility, of deepening crises, of the kind of bullshit rationalizations that are represented by the dominant ideology are easier to pierce. So the ideological aspect of the superstructures are likely to become more fragile. In Gramscian terms, it means that this would represent a shift from a hegemonic capitalism to just a repressive dominant capitalism. The question is, why does the domination aspect of capitalist superstructures also become more vulnerable? The ideological ones, sure, we can see why that becomes more vulnerable, easier to demystify. Why does the repressive apparatus? Well, I think there's two kinds of arguments that are implicit in the fragility of the superstructure part of this thesis. First, it takes resources to effectively run the state and the machinery of ideology. These resources come out of the social surplus. So if capitalism is in more or less continual and deepening economic crisis because of this collapse of the rate of profit, it becomes more difficult to fund these social overhead costs. The fiscal crisis of the state is one symptom of this, and the fiscal crisis of the state undermines the repressive capacity of the state. Because it becomes itself in competition with capital. If you have this declining surplus and the state has to appropriate more and more of it to reproduce capitalism, that just makes the crisis conditions worse. Right? So one reason why the superstructure of the state becomes more disrupted itself and less capable of reproducing capitalism is that it's expensive. A superstructure that has to engage in this kind of pervasive repression. But secondly, and I think this is probably certainly as important in a modern complex world, if capitalism ceases to be able to deliver the goods and becomes mired in these sort of endless crises, then it would become difficult to maintain solid allegiance of the rank and file personnel of the state itself. So one aspect of the intensification of class struggle, which is the thesis too, you know, this intensification of class struggle, is the emergence of anti-capitalist political leadership offering a vision of an alternative to capitalism, which is increasingly attractive to many people not firmly in the working class, including the personnel of the state. So once capitalism ceases to provide a credible vision for the future, that's the loss of its hegemonic, capacity, then counter-hegemonic visions become attractive to significant parts of the state apparatus itself. We observe this happening, although not in exactly the way that I am describing it, in actual revolutionary contexts. I mean, after all, the actual revolutionary context of the Bolshevik Revolution was a collapse of the confidence of state personnel in the state. But that was because of World War I. I mean, I think in the absence of World War I, it's pretty implausible that the Tsarist state would have lost its capacity to maintain the loyalty of its own repressive apparatus. It was in the context of the devastation of World War I that that happened. That's not part of the traditional Marxist argument. The traditional Marxist argument is not that the state loses its capacity for social reproduction because of its defeat in inter-imperialist wars. No, it's because it loses its capacity for these endogenous social system reasons. Marx, in this revolutionary transformation thesis, Marx himself is pretty vague about the actual process by which a revolution would occur, the process through which this destruction of the political superstructure of capitalism would occur. So the key move, just to repeat the story, is what a revolution means is a destruction of the superstructure. That's what revolutions target. A revolution is a revolution against the superstructure so as to make possible the transformation of the economic structure. As long as the superstructure is intact, you can't transform the relations of production, because that's what superstructures do. They reproduce the relations of production through ideology and through domination. The ideology part gets taken care of beforehand because it's eroded and corroded by the crises of capitalism. Then there's this moment where there's enough defection within the state, enough fracturing of its own internal cohesion, that the state can be conquered. And then the state is transformed into a suitable instrument for transforming the economic structure. That's the kind of sequencing. So the state is the target of revolution, but it's not the ultimate objective. So revolutions aren't political coups of one faction over another. Revolutions are taking over state power, transforming the machinery of the state to make it a suitable instrument for transforming the underlying economic structure. But Marx was pretty unclear, didn't ever elaborate the process by which that would occur. Sometimes it's seen in this kind of insurrectionary mode. That's the kind of classical way that it developed later in the 20th century, a kind of insurrectional view of seizing the state by force. But Marx himself at times entertained the possibility that this could all happen through ordinary democratic processes. There's nothing in the theory itself which says that the seizure of state power and the transformation of the machinery of the state needs to occur through violent revolution. That's just an empirical observation about how it's happened in certain cases. And an intuition by certain styles of revolutionary politics, but the theory itself doesn't say that the only way to overcome superstructures is through their violent destruction. The theory is perfectly consistent with saying superstructures have enough internal contradictions that you could gain state power through ordinary democratic elections, and then you could institute the necessary transformations of the state needed to have a longer-term transformation of the underlying economic structure. The basic fundamental argument is not about the means by which you would transform superstructures, but about their transformability. Once capitalism becomes a moribund economic system, the superstructures of capitalism will no longer indefinitely be able to effectively reproduce capitalism in the face of intensified class struggles for its radical transformation, so that those superstructures will be transformable themselves because of these sort of knock-on effects of the fragility of capitalism. And how that happens, I think the theory says that's historically contingent. Doesn't really give us an account Okay, thesis four, the transition to capitalism thesis, to socialism thesis. Okay, given the ultimate non-sustainability of capitalism thesis one, and the interests and capacities of the social actors arrayed against capitalism, that's thesis two, in the aftermath of the destruction of capitalism through intensified class struggle, thesis three, socialism, defined as a society in which the system of production is collectively owned and controlled through egalitarian democratic institutions, that's a very general abstract definition of socialism, collective ownership controlled through egalitarian democratic institutions, is the most likely successor, since the collectively organized working class will be in the best position to ensure that its interests are embodied in the new post-capitalist institutions. That's the transition to socialism thesis. So, how do we understand that claim? I mean, Marx's claim is not just that eventually, because capitalism is weakened and the working class becomes strong enough and the superstructures become fragile, that you will get a destruction of capitalism. It's also a claim about what comes next. Strictly speaking, the first three theses only predict that capitalism will eventually come to an end and be superseded by something. But it doesn't. They don't by themselves really give us much of a prediction as to what's going to come after. Nevertheless, I think Marx and other thinkers in the Marxist tradition had an optimistic view of the prospects of post-capitalism being actually desirable, not that post-capitalism will just be another form of nasty exploitation and domination. They had arguments for this optimism. And of course, the optimism of what comes after capitalism was absolutely fundamental to the desire to destroy capitalism. You know, the desire to destroy it was not just because you're pissed off and want to wreck the system in which you're living. It's because of a belief that in so doing, you could build something better. And that the thing that's better would be built through conscious purpose. It's not something that will just sort of spontaneously exist. It's something that human beings have to create. Well, what are the grounds of the optimism? I think there are three reasons, implicit, sometimes explicit, but you know, embedded in the theory, which give you reasonable grounds for optimism. First, capitalism raises the level of productivity enormously, which means that post-capitalist society, in post-capitalist society, scarcity, in a broad sense, will have been largely overcome. This is a key part of Marx's own argument. It's an argument that kind of got sidelined because of the historical circumstances in which actual revolutions were attempted. One could hardly argue that the revolution in China occurred at a time when scarcity had been largely overcome, right? It was an extremely poor and backward economic structure with the mass of the population engaged in low productivity agriculture. But Marx's own optimism came from the view that capitalism itself would have solved one of the crucial problems of humanity, that is producing a very high productivity economy in which the problem of scarcity, meaning how much toil is needed to produce the basics of life, the problem of scarcity would have been largely overcome. This makes a more egalitarian distribution easier to sustain. A more egalitarian distribution doesn't mean great deprivations for people. But it also, and I think this is a pretty important feature, it liberates time for people to engage in the collective responsibilities of democratically running an economy. I mean, Oscar Wilde famously said, the problem with socialism is it takes up too many evenings. And that's true. But if you are liberated from time so that your work week is 10 hours a week, then socialism takes up a bunch of afternoons, and probably only part of the afternoons. You know, it's less of a burden on people's lives. If the time allocation of activities between producing the means of necessity and reproducing the social relations under which you live gets shifted. So if democracy and democratic control over an economic system becomes a part of the ordinary way people think of what they do with their lives, then it just folded into a work day or a work week without it being an excessive burden any more than it is for current managers who participate in making those decisions. I mean, maybe it's a burden for them because of the oppressive conditions under which management occurs, but okay, productivity is the first reason for optimism. Secondly, and this is a kind of ironic feature of capitalism, capitalism develops these mega corporations, which already kind of constitute a sort of quasi-social form of property. That is, they already are organizations that have to have a huge apparatus of decision-making, of information flows, of social coordination. They are internally run like planned economies. Right? So Michael Burovoy has this fantastic discussion. It's one of his most brilliant comparisons of the difference between the way large factories were run in Hungary and in the United States. He worked in both of them. He worked as a steel worker in the furnaces in Hungary, as well as a machinist in a factory in the United States. And he said, in Hungary, inside of the factory, it was run like a market. But in its relation with other firms, it was run, like a plan. It was planned with respect to its external environment. It was internally run like a market. Everything was bargained. There was horse trading. There was all of this bargaining and market-like activities inside of the firm. In the American large corporation, internally, it's run like a state. You have a command structure and things are allocated according to a plan. And externally, it's run like a market. And he then played out the implications of these two different logics of organization and environment in these two economies. Well, Marx, one of the reasons for optimism about capitalism is if you get these gigantic corporations that have hundreds of thousands of employees in them that are already being run in a planned way, you've kind of done part of the work of building an alternative economy. It's just that you built it inside of these firms and they're authoritarian rather than participatory. Although Marx never really commented, as far as I know, on that issue. And Lenin famously extolled the virtues of Taylorism, of this kind of totally top-down internal organization of the factory on the grounds that it was the most efficient and the workers in a factory wanted to be as efficient as possible. And if that means being under the control of scientific management, well, so be it. That's just the best way of doing it. Anyway, the large capitalist firm is an advantage for socialism, not a disadvantage, because you've already done a semi-socialization of the process of production. And finally, there was a source of optimism that came from the very process by which capitalism would be overthrown, which was that in order to overthrow capitalism, the working class had to become a coherent, powerful, organized political force. This means that it is in the position to construct the kind of alternative that best embodies its interests. And there's something to that. If the scenario was right, if the rest of the theory was adequate, it would be the case that the only way you can fight against capitalism at the level of the game itself is if you have a really coherent collective capacity for struggle, which means that you're that collective organization, whether it be political, whether we label it a political party or we label it a social movement or whatever, but that collectivity of action, of concentrated action, is in the position to craft the alternative. Fundamentally, I think, in terms of the design, well, what is it going to craft? Marx had almost nothing to say. There are these passages in his discussion of the Paris Commune where he sketches out a few ideas about what the alternative to capitalism would be like, but really those should be thought of as gestures. They're just snippets of ideas. They're not really an attempt at playing out an institutional design. His intuitions were basically, I think, that there are two crucial things that would render socialism the successor to capitalism. Private ownership of the means of production would be replaced by some kind of collective ownership. but he's pretty silent on what that would be, whether it's state ownership or whether it's cooperatives or whether it's communes or some other form, you know, exactly what the antinomy of private is. It's public, but what, that's not an institutional description. And he also argued that the market would be replaced by comprehensive planning. It's pretty clear that Marx himself thought that the market itself was a destructive force and that it should be replaced by comprehensive planning. But he doesn't really defend that argument. He doesn't really give us an account of how a comprehensively planned economy could work and whether actually what you want is some combination of planning and markets articulated in some new form, but without the concentration of power in the market that would block a planned market. You know, so the idea of a market socialism was not something that Marx entertained. But I don't think that really matters. I mean, it only matters because some people took Marx's little sketchy claims too seriously. They took them as principles that had to be followed, and that's partially because of the ideological standing that Marxism got to have. It, you know, it became an ideology of revolution, not a science of revolution. And so every passage in Marx was gleaned for the truths that it contained. That's essentially a biblical reading of Marx that really should have no place in a political movement that is serious about the problem of how do you create a sustainable emancipatory alternative. We know, which is one reason why I think that markets are absolutely essential under conditions of complexity. And then the question is, how do you organize markets in such a way that they can be contained and subordinated to democratic will, as opposed to that they get out of hand and end up subverting democratic possibilities. So Marx only sketched it. In the end, then, I think in terms of the transition to socialism thesis, what we really have is a deterministic theory of the demise of capitalism and a relatively voluntaristic theory of the construction of the alternative. You know, when people say Marxism is not a deterministic theory, I think they're wrong. That's an incorrect description of its theory of the demise of capitalism. That part of the theory is deterministic. It's a real prediction, just like climate change is a real prediction. Climate scientists say, conditional on the parameters remaining the same, this is our future. Climate sciences are not deterministic in saying that the parameters are unalterable by human action, right? So climate science is voluntaristic in its view about the human capacity to do something about these parameters. It's our actions that have caused the parameters to be out of whack, that is the carbon emissions to raise the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and human action could do something about it. Climate scientists aren't political scientists, so they don't have anything to say about the causal processes underlying our political capacity to do something about it. That's our job as social scientists. But climate science is certainly deterministic about the future, given those parameters. Marxism is deterministic about the future of capitalism, given the dynamics of capitalism, and given the parameters that he saw in place in the 19th century. Now it turns out, and now we'll turn to the, there's one more thesis, right? I have the communism destination thesis. I'm not going to spend too much time on the communism destination thesis. The communism destination thesis is a utopian aspirational claim. It's framed as if it were of the same piece as the socialism transition to socialism thesis, but I think that's really incorrect. The transition to socialism thesis is a scientific claim about the likely successor to capitalism. It's a statement that, yes, the working class will have the collective capacity to craft a society that will be post-capitalist in a way that serves its interests, And at its heart, it will either eliminate or subordinate private property, and either eliminate or subordinate the market to collective will. Thesis four is a scientific claim. Thesis five about the withering away of the state, a classless society in which distribution is to each according to need, from each according to ability, where you will need no repressive apparatus to coordinate or to constrain violations of the rules of the game. That's an aspirational vision of a utopian character. It's not a real utopian proposition, although plenty of Marxists have treated it as another prediction. But I don't think there's any argument in Marx, none. I mean, it's not that there's only sketches. There really is no argument in Marx that the coordination problems under conditions of complexity in a post-scarcity, a more democratic and egalitarian world will have self-enforcing rules of the game that only need norms, that need no authoritative coordination, and therefore it surely needs a state of some sort. I'm not going to focus on that. Let's turn to the inadequacies of the theory, the problems in this array. We'll discuss the particular question of the character of the alternative and how to think about that. That's really what we're going to focus on next week, and on the particular strategic question about how we could get to that alternative, how to be an anti-capitalist in the 21st century. That's the focus of our discussion and our celebratory weekend in the woods. Okay, let's go through the inadequacies of this theory. Before saying that, I just want to just once again reiterate the extraordinary character of the argument. You know, it's as an intellectual construction, it is one of the most ambitious pieces of social theory ever, in which the logic of its interdependent parts are just, I think, stunning. And in which, as a theoretical argument written in the 1860s-ish, plus or minus, you know, some of it came earlier, some of it spilled into a little bit later, based on the available evidence of that era, it's a fantastic simulation of the future and totally plausible. You know, it's not that it was inherently wrong. It just turns out to be, I think, unsatisfactory. But it's a really fantastic piece of theoretical work. And for, you know, those of you who eventually become professors, what I really recommend when you teach this stuff is that you really try to get students to appreciate how ambitious it is, how difficult it is to produce a coherent theory that is this ambitious, and then to really pinpoint its problems rather than to have a kind of sweeping claim, well, the world didn't turn out that way, therefore we don't need to pay attention to it. Because some of the ways in which it fails also help inform what kind of a theory we need if we want to continue to hold on to the emancipatory objectives, which are really driving the theory in the first place. All right, well, let's go through the problems. I think there are four main conceptual weaknesses, or conceptual and empirical, you know, problems in this theory, criticisms that I'd like to focus on. The first is the theory of crisis intensifications. There are a number of reasons to be skeptical of Marx's versions of the self-destructive theory thesis, that is, that capitalism destroys its own conditions of existence. But there's a couple of interesting alternatives, sort of contemporary neo-Marxist views as to how there may still be self-destructive tendencies, just not the ones that were specifically identified by Marx. Let me just mention the problems with Marx's own view of it first. First of all, while capitalism contains a variety of processes which tend to produce periodic economic disruptions, Marx greatly underestimated the extent to which state interventions could modify those tendencies. That is, his theory of crisis management was entirely dependent upon capitalists themselves managing the crisis tendencies. You know, they had to themselves adapt their business strategies in a response to crises, and that was the only tool of crisis management available. And that wasn't a bad view of the 19th century, where when crises occurred, the state kind of threw its hands up in despair. The state did very little to deal with the disruptions that occurred. And indeed, there was a kind of hands-off view. There was a view that, well, things will burn themselves out, capitalism will restore its own conditions of profitability, give it time. There were some minimalist state efforts to deal with some of the human suffering that occurred, but not even much of that. You know, there were poorhouses to deal with displacement, but it was pretty thin in the 19th century. So Marx saw crisis management as entirely an affair of the economy. Well, what was discovered in the 20th century was that there's a hell of a lot the state can do, and that these turn out to be pretty effective if sometimes badly deployed. Pretty effective in containing the severity of crises. So really severe crises aren't all that common. They do happen. But even the really severe ones that we have now, you know, the financial crisis of 2007 and 8 in the United States was pretty severe by any reckoning. It still didn't wreck the economy. It still only produced unemployment rates in the 10 or 12 or 15% range, depending upon how you measure them. Not the 50 or 60% range. Most people continued to earn an income and continued to pretty much do what they had done before, if with higher levels of anxiety. So the first problem is Marx never entertained the possibility that the state could play such a role. Secondly, while the rate of profit may be lower in highly developed capitalist societies than in earlier ones, there really doesn't appear any secular tendency for it to approach zero. And if it settles down to a low but a low level around which then oscillations occur, there's no reason why that should produce this intensification process. Yeah?
Could you, for the first problem still, could you say that as, I guess, capitalists and capitalist firms become more and more intertwined with other state policies, that eventually those, I guess, self-destructive tendencies will, I guess, like seep into the state, and to a point that even state intervention will no longer be enough?
Well, if capitalism becomes more intertwined with the state, state interventions to reproduce capitalism in the face of crisis should improve, not get worse, because the state would have to bother less with other responsibilities. That is, the fact that there's a tight connection between state and capital, that it's capitalists who are in the Treasury Department and in the Fed, you know, people with strong ties to Wall Street are in the Federal Reserve Bank and in the Treasury Department and in all the parts of the state that have as their responsibility dealing with crisis, that should improve the efficiency of the state's ability to dampen crises. It'll do so in the interests of capital, that's true, and that will piss people off, but it won't destabilize capitalism. It won't, in terms of this crisis intensification mechanism, it would still block that mechanism. There's another reason why, however, and this is one of the alternatives we'll get to, why the relationship between the state and capital may in fact have a new form of self-destructive capacity, but I don't think it's because of the intertwining of the two. Let me just finish this and I'll get to that in just one moment. So the second thing is that the rate of profit doesn't seem to have this long-term tendency to decline to zero. The third issue is that Marx's fundamental argument about the law of the falling rate of profit, that is that it's driven by the rise in capital intensity because only labor produces surplus, that argument turns out to be really, I think, deeply flawed for two kinds of reasons. One is the labor theory of value itself is an unsatisfactory theory of value. That's a technical argument, and we won't go into that. But even if the labor theory of value was the right way to think about value, so that the surplus product is really surplus value in labor terms. The fact of the matter is that once you get a fully mechanized economy, subsequent improvements in productivity take the form of replacing one kind of machine with another kind of machine. Right? And sometimes that lowers capital intensity. It doesn't raise it. It lowers capital intensity. I mean, the simplest example is in the 1960s, if you were an accountant, you had these big mechanical adding machines. You know, they were really expensive. They cost, in contemporary terms, they would have cost thousands of dollars. They had lots of gears and levers and, you know, adding machines and multiplying machines were physical machines. They weren't computers. Now for, you know, $20, you can have a adding machine, a handheld little adding machine that's a computer, that is vastly more powerful than anything that was available in the 1950s, and they're cheap. Once you've shifted to the digital forms, you're replacing previously expensive forms with cheaper forms. Once machines begin to replace machines, there's no reason why the new machines have to embody more capital. The new machines can be cheaper. So there's no tendency for, you know, capital intensity doesn't tend to just increase in a linear fashion. Do you know what the most capital intensive sector in the United States is? People think it's like steel or autos. It turns out to be wheat farms. Wheat farms are the most capital intensive. These gigantic combines cost $800,000 or something like that. One person drives them and the land is expensive. You know, if you just look at the total cost of capital per person, they're the highest in wheat, higher than steel production and auto production. Those are the reasons why the classic falling rate of profit arguments and crisis intensification don't work. But there may be new sources of crisis intensification. One does concern the relationship of the state to the economy, and it's bound up with globalization, but not rather than the intertwining of state and economy, namely that the state's capacity to manage crises goes down when the jurisdiction of the state is national but the economy is organized globally. And the crisis mechanisms are generated globally. That makes it a much tougher problem to regulate the capitalist system, even in the interests of capital. Because you don't have a regulatory agency at the level of geographical scale at which capitalists can individually organize their strategies. Now, how devastating a problem that is a matter of dispute. Somebody like Wolfgang Streck thinks it's a huge problem. Other people feel that actually there's enough crisis management possible within the big, powerful economies, within the United States, increasingly within China, within the EU, in spite of its problems, that there's no reason to imagine that this will get out of control in some kind of death spiral. The other crisis tendency that may have an intensification character is the environment. That the crises generated by the environment and by global warming as the iconic case, but not just global warming, may spiral out of control in a way that undermines the conditions of existence of capitalism, makes it fragile once again. Now the problem with that as the scenario is it also doesn't create very favorable conditions for a democratic egalitarian alternative. I mean, Trotsky said the alternative to capitalism, I think Trotsky, maybe it was Luxembourg, socialism or barbarism. What?
Luxembourg.
Well, Trotsky also probably mimicked, repeated it. Socialism or barbarism. You know, if the demise of capitalism comes through ecological collapse, barbarism is a far more likely outcome than socialism. It's much more likely that powerful forces will use their capacity for gated, Blade Runner type bifurcation of the world into the privileged, guarded, to maintain their standards of living, and the rest of the world marginalized and repressed. ecological disaster doesn't seem to me a good recipe for a democratic egalitarian future. There's a third source of contradiction in contemporary capitalism, which is an entirely different character, which isn't bound up with the intensification of crises, but which may indeed signal a deepening vulnerability of capitalism. And that's the increasing importance of intellectual property to the very possibility of capital accumulation. Intellectual property is way more vulnerable to expropriation, not by the state, but by the masses. That is piracy as a way of undercutting the value of intellectual property. It's just tremendously easier to steal intellectual property than it is to steal a factory. You know, and if the key to productivity and to profitability is intellectual property, as some people argue, and if that's increasingly the case, then the system becomes more vulnerable because its property rights become harder to defend, and they may become impossible to defend. So the ability for people to create non-capitalist circuits of production using stolen intellectual property, which is subsequently developed, and then, or to create alternative forms of development of intellectual property, creative commons, copyleft, I mean, all these new devices for licensing intellectual property in non-commodified, non-capitalist ways. Who knows where this will go, whether this in the end will make capitalism much more vulnerable. Now that still has a Marxian type explanation because it is bound up with property rights, it is bound up with class, it is bound up with relations and forces of production. It just doesn't work through a mechanism of crisis intensification within capitalism. You get the vulnerability of capitalist property rights for a different reason. And I think that's a kind of attractive idea. It's one of the themes that I work on in my Real Utopias framework, the extent to which the building of alternatives to capitalism inside of a capitalist world becomes easier, because some of the key components of production are no longer so easy for capitalists to monopolize. Basically because they're not, the scarcity of capital disappears. The intellectual property has this feature that, knowledge has this feature that once it's produced, you just have to tell somebody about it and then they own it, except that they're not allowed to use it because of this thing called intellectual property. It's just way more vulnerable. All right, that's the theory of crisis intensification, the theory of proletarianization. So clearly I'm not going to get through all this today. These criticisms are important and interesting enough that this will just segue into the next time as well. So I don't want to short circuit this. Let me begin the theory of proletarianization. So this is the second major problem in the Marxist theory. The increasing increasing size of the working class and its ultimate capacity for struggle depended crucially on a vision for how the capitalist class structure would develop over time. Now, it's certainly true that in the course of capitalist development, an increasing proportion of the labor force is incorporated into capitalist employment relations. That's true. But in the developed capitalist world, this hasn't really resulted in a continual process of proletarianization and class homogenization. Rather, it's resulted in a trajectory of increasing complexity of class structures. So unless you define the working class as all employees of capitalist firms, if you just say employees, that's the working class, if you put any other conditionality on it, like managers and executives are not in the working class and highly paid professionals are not in the working class, and then depending upon how you theorize what they're in, what we have is a vastly fragmented and complex class structure, not an increasingly homogeneous and polarized class structure. Now, it's still possible to argue at the level of the game itself that many of these class positions that seem at odds with the working class at the level of the rules of the game are really sharing common interests with the working class at the level of the game itself. The problem is that that heterogeneity at the level of the rules of the game really blocks the possibility of forming collective, common class formations at the level of the game itself. That transition becomes more problematic because of the character of this differentiation. Then there's another issue around proletarianization, which I think is just as important as fragmentation. And that has to do with the material conditions of life, even if the working class was homogeneous, which it's not, but the material conditions of life of average workers in developed capitalist countries. By any measure of material standards of living, things have improved for the median in the developed capitalist world. And probably even if you went down to the 20th percentile, you know, people in the bottom at that 20th percentile, it's probably the case that in the last 50 years, in the course of lives of people who are kind of at retirement age today, at the 20th percentile, that their material conditions of life have improved. I don't mean that their income has improved. I just mean their material conditions of life have improved. Certainly at the median, it's the case. The median in the United States has improved quite a lot. If you look at all the relevant indicators, if you look at life expectancy, if you look at health, if you look at square feet of living space, if you look at the consumer goods, which are standard indoor plumbing, refrigerators, dishwashers, you know, whatever you want to include in that list, a higher percentage of people have those things now than had them 50 years ago at every point in the income distribution until you get way, way down to the most destitute and marginalized part of the population. Now, that doesn't mean that the quality of life has improved. There's increasing insecurity, there's a lot of anxiety, and inequality itself has negative effects. It's not just what your absolute level of living is. It is where you fit within a structure of inequality. So all of these things matter. So I'm not making the conservative argument, why are people bitching, right? No, but it's still, there's a difference between asking people, what's your views about an alternative to capitalism, when it is plausible to say, workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains and a world to win, then when the workers you're appealing to have smartphones and own their own homes, mostly, the majority of working class people are homeowners in the United States. That's not quite the same as envisioned in the strong proletarianization thesis. So the proletarianization thesis runs into problems both because of fragmentation, heterogeneity in the class structure, but also because of the material wealth of the society, which does trickle down enough that even though it's not the case that the gap between the way people could live and the way they live has shrunk, that is the quality of life that people would have under an alternative structure of economic relations, that gap is huge for the average person and certainly for people in the bottom tiers of the income distribution, but the actual level in which they live has improved. And that complicates the whole proletarianization thesis. It weakens its force as a part of an explanation for why we can predict the future. All right, we'll continue through this list on Monday and then segue into the topic of the alternatives, which is next week's. See you then.